At the end of the day.
Good morning. I am Walter Mahoney. I'm the attorney representing Floyd Dale Wilkins in this case. Mr. Wilkins was found guilty of contempt by Judge Pat Gregory out of probate court number 2 in Harris County, Texas. He was found guilty for violating an oral order rendered by the court on January 22, 1982. Almost two years later, on January 20th of 1984, a hearing was held wherein Mr. Wilkins was found guilty of violating the judge's oral order of January 22nd. The first contention of Mr. Wilkins is that an individual cannot be held in constructive contempt for violation of an oral order. That decision or that position is based on many appellate court cases dealing with construction of orders and in the area mainly of family law, but certainly which deal with interpretations of court's orders. And basically, the position is, as far as Mr. Wilkins is concerned, that if a person can be held in violation of an oral order of the court, in contempt for violation of an oral order of the court, he's unable to know prior to the trial of the case just exactly what he is being charged with prior to the hearing. In this particular case, Judge Gregory, at the close, after both sides had rested, recited from the bench his recollection of his order. And it is our position that that formed a substantial basis for the finding of contempt. It is impossible for a defendant in a contempt proceeding to know what a judge's recollection of an order is going to be. So if you can be held in constructive contempt for violation of an oral order, the due process requirements previously established by these courts would not apply to somebody in this type of a situation. The second contention of Mr. Wilkins is that the order in this particular case was not sufficiently clear and specific to be subject to a contempt proceeding. Before that issue can even be reached, a determination must be made of exactly what the order in this case was.
How do we have any idea what the order in this case was?
Your Honor,
was there a court reporter present when the oral order was pronounced?
I cannot answer that question because I was not present, but there is no transcript of those proceedings before the court today.
Is the docket sheet entry the best evidence we have of whatever the judge's order was?
The docket sheet entry and the judge's recollection is the only evidence before this court of what the order was. The docket sheet entry does not even mention Mr. Wilkins' name. It merely recites, and I believe it's before the court, 122-82, motion by Dennis Kelly to turn over assets, specifically $80,000 he claims as a gift, funds to be deposited in Texas and not to be spent, alienated, or bifurcated in any matter until title resolved. And that is the extent.
When, where, or anything?
No, Your Honor, it didn't. It didn't say when, where, how, or enable the defendant, and I think this goes to our third point, that was the extent of the information the defendant had prior to his hearing on this contempt charge. That was all he knew to prepare a defense for, and it was basically impossible to prepare any type of a defense. There was no allegation of when he violated the order or when he was to have performed under the order. And our final position, and again, that goes along the same lines with the issue of whether or not you can be held in constructive contempt for violation of an oral order, is that the contempt order, the commitment order, does not state specifically when he violated the order of the court. And again, I think that is based on the fact that there was no time to perform. He was merely ordered to bring the funds to Texas without any designation of when, how, or in what fashion, or for how long. That's basically the extent of all I have. If the court has any questions, I'll... Thank you.
We'll hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Washington, Mr. Bowen, if you give argument for the respondent, Mr. Washington will open.
May it please the court, I'm Marshall Watkins, attorney at Watkins and Williams, practicing in Houston, Texas. I am before this court both as an attorney and I am the temporary administrator of the estate of Franklin Carnahan, which is one of the respondents in this writ of habeas corpus. Mr. Wilkins was held in contempt of court by the Honorable Pat Gregory in January of 1984 for violation of an oral order rendered January 22, 1982. Our points that we wish to urge to this court today are, one, that an oral order can be the basis of contempt provided it is specific enough. Number two, that the order in this case was specific. And number three, that the motion to adjudge Floyd Dale Wilkins in contempt adequately apprised him of the charges against him to afford him due process and enable him to prepare a defense to the case. Point number one, an oral order can be the basis of contempt. We cited Ex parte Barnes in our brief, which is a case arising out of a family law situation in which a temporary injunction had been issued orally before it could be reduced to writing. The injunction enjoined the parties from coming together and meeting, etc. They happened to meet, not by chance, an accident. And out of that, problems arose which led to a contempt action. The court, while not holding the party in contempt, did say that an oral order, provided it is specific enough and of which the party has notice, can be the basis of a contempt citation.
Is that a no writ case?
Yes, Your Honor. Most of the Court of Appeal cases are no writ because I don't believe this court has jurisdiction.
I understand.
Yes, Your Honor. That case also cited Ex parte Stone, which is a 1903 Court of Criminal Appeals case wherein in litigation was an whether somebody could be held in contempt for violating an injunction. And the court in that case held that the person in that particular situation could not be held in contempt for violating the injunction because they had not been served with the injunction and had no knowledge of the injunction. But the court said that it did not matter that the injunction had not been reduced to writing, et cetera, but they would not hold that party in contempt for the reason that they were not neither served nor had anybody communicated knowledge to them of the court's injunction, and that was the basis of that holding. But Ex parte Stone does stand for the proposition that an oral order can be the basis of contempt.
Are those your two citations?
Yes, Your Honor.
You hang your hat on those two citations.
Plus the citations, I cited some cases by way, not by way of limitation, but way of example from other jurisdictions where they enforce in their courts oral orders that are specific as the basis of contempt.
I think the sizable number of cases on the other side of that too.
I'm not sure, Your Honor, and I'm not representing to the court that my research is exhaustive by any means.
I may suggest you read Ex parte Spencer.
Ex parte Spencer.
Let's forget about all the case law. Let's just talk as a matter of what's right. How could an appellate court ever review an oral order to determine whether or not it was sufficient? And gave sufficient notice.
The court is speaking absent of a court reporter being present.
Yeah, absent of a court reporter. Apparently all we've got to go on here is the docket sheet entry.
And the recollection of
And the recollection 2 years later of the trial judge.
And the testimony of Mr. Bowers, who was present at the hearing, and the relator's sworn pleadings, wherein he relates that by court order, the funds were returned to the state of Texas to be held pending adjudication of the title dispute, which goes to his knowledge of the order and his understanding of what the court's order was.
And based on that, we're supposed to be able to decide whether or not there's been a violation of the order.
Based on that, you're supposed to be able to decide what the terms of the order was, and then we believe we made in the trial court sufficient proof in the contempt hearing that that order was violated. Yes, Your Honor. This court in Ex parte Padron, 1978 case, had a situation before it where a constructive contempt had tried to be converted into a direct contempt, whereby while the person was present before the trial court issued an oral order requiring the person to do something and then held him in contempt for violating that oral order. The court ruled that a constructive contempt proceeding could not be converted to an oral contempt proceeding there when the person had only been put on notice that he was on being charged with violating something on a constructive basis. And this court said oral orders are poor substitutes for requirement of one final judgment. And I would readily admit that they are poor substitutes, but that doesn't mean that they're not substitutes. It's our position that a valid order of a court, be it oral or written, of which a person has knowledge and which is specific, is to be followed. It's not to be contemptuously disobeyed. And I recited by way of hypothetical in my brief, if a court issues an temporary injunction whereby parties are before the court, can a party then leave the courtroom and go violate that injunction because it has not been reduced to writing? Parties rarely know what the exact words of the court's order is going to be. And it's always a matter of going out and preparing it, reducing it to writing and having it signed. Is that party free to then leave that courtroom and violate that order because it has not been reduced to writing? I submit to the court that that cannot be the law. Rule 306A directs all judges, clerks, lawyers to use every means possible to have all orders of the court reduced to writing and signed and dated. But it also says that's for use of the date for the purposes of the timetable on appeal. It does not determine when an order is rendered for any other purposes. I'd like to discuss briefly the cases, all of them family law cases that arose that stand for the proposition that an oral order cannot be the basis of contempt. We begin with Ex parte Groder, which is cited in the relator's brief. Austin Court of Appeals opinion in 1978, wherein the court stated that there were two orders issued. One, November 9, 1976, ordered to pay $500 a month child support and temporary alimony. And then subsequent to that, apparently a July 15, 77 order that is not mentioned in the record as far as what the terms were, other than makes a vague reference that the man is supposed to pay $350 per month child support. That order goes on, that opinion goes on to cite Slavin, opinion out of this court, and requirements of Slavin, and then makes a statement that an oral order can never meet the requirements of Slavin. It cites no basis for that proposition, simply states that proposition.
Well, Slavin says that an order must be so clear that you can understand it while you're running. It spells out when, where, what, everything. How can an oral order do that?
By way of argument, Justice Pope, hypothesize with me that a person is before the bench, court reporter's present. The court instructs him, I order you to do thus and so, and then ask him, sir, do you understand my order? Yes. Will you tell me in your own words what my order is? He tells the court in his own words, do you have any questions about my order? I believe in that situation, the court can hypothesize a situation with me where that order can be specific enough.
We have drawn a clear distinction between a direct contempt, that is something that's done right in the presence of the judge order him to be quiet or to do something, and he disobeyed that. That's a direct contempt. But we have here a constructive contempt, where something has been happened a long time after some kind of an order, and it's an entirely different body of law that applies to the constructive contempt. Would be required to go to trial even on a misdemeanor without a complaint or an indictment before him, something that he could read to see what he was charged with?
No, Your Honor, I would not.
Go ahead.
Those temporary injunction cases you spoke to, were they all subsequently reduced to writing?
Were they all subsequently reduced to writing? I'm going to be honest with the court, and I do not recall.
I'm familiar with the rule that you can be charged with notice of a restraint if you're present in the courtroom. But were the actual contempt all based on the substantive reduction of that to writing when a person was charged with violating this order that he'd heard standing there in the courtroom?
Ex parte Barnes that I've cited the court to, the temporary injunction, if there was to reduce the writing, the action that was the basis of the contempt took place in between the oral order and it being reduced to writing.
I understand, but the judge did reduce it to writing before hearing on the contempt.
Yes, sir, but how would that help the person's knowledge at the time they violated the order when it hadn't been reduced to writing at that point in time? And just if I may continue my hypothetical, I was not talking about a where they went through that soliloquy at the bench and then the person violated the order in the presence of the court. I'm talking about then they leave the courtroom and do something in violation of that order. I would submit to the court, and that, under that hypothetical, they would clearly understand what their duties were, and even if the court had not reviewed the writing, they should be able to be held in contempt of court. And I'd like to also address in a moment the distinction between direct and constructive contempt. As the court pointed out, there's a different body of law that's come down with direct contempt for two reasons. One, for the orderly of the court's business, it must have the authority to maintain its proper decorum. And two, the other basis for direct contempt is the court needs to hear no evidence of the contempt with its own senses. But that doesn't go to the issue of whether the order that the court informed the contempt was specific enough. Because there are cases where a person has been released when they've been held in contempt for direct contempt, where the court's order was ambiguous. I also cite a hypothetical in my brief. Can a person be in court and the court order them not to do something, and then they leave that subjective area that's considered to be the presence of the court and go upstairs in the courtroom or downstairs that does something in relation to that order that affects the administration of the proceeding before court? Can they escape contempt proceedings because they've left the presence of the court? I don't think that should be the law.
Was there a show cause motion? We don't have it in the record, at least it's something like that.
Your Honor, I filed a supplemental transcript this morning that contains the original motion for show cause, the affidavits filed in support of that, contain citations for, and it's important for this reason that Mr. Wilkins was never served with the show cause citation. He voluntarily appeared by written answer, which is also part of the supplemental transcript. And it's my position that that then has him relying, or we're relying on, the motion to show cause plus the affidavits, and it takes it away from what's recited in the order to show cause, because he was never served with that order to show cause. He voluntarily appeared by written answer.
We've got an additional problem here then, don't we, if he was never served by show cause?
Not if he appeared, Your Honor, and subjected himself to jurisdiction of the court, took part in proceedings.
What does the show cause order charge?
The show cause order, first of all, Your Honor, it makes mention of and requires that a copy of the motion to show cause be attached to the order. The order is revised 1982 court order by hypothecating or disposing of the funds. With regard to the order in question, how specific it was, the court has before it Judge Gregory's docket sheet. The court has before it, or in the record, is the testimony from Mr. William Bowers, who was present at the January 22, 1982 hearing, and who testified in court as to what the court's order was. The court has before it the certified copy of the relator's petition for declaratory relief 1, which was introduced into evidence, whereby he states his understanding of what the court's order is, which is no different in content from what the court's order actually was. And I submit to the what the content it has been, and that is that he should return the funds to the state of Texas, maintain them in an institution within the trial court's jurisdiction, and not to dispose of those funds until adjudication of title. He's being charged with disposing of those funds. Not with what bank he put them in, not maintaining them in an interest-bearing account. He's being charged with disposing of those funds. And the court's order is clear as to that point. You must consider the court's order in light of the proceeding in which it was made. There was a proceeding whereby the title to the funds were in controversy. The court did not require Mr. Wilkins to deposit them in the registry of the court. The court mainly required Mr. Wilkins to maintain them in an institution within the court's jurisdiction until title to those funds could be adjudicated. finally like to address Mr. Wilkins' contention that the motion to adjudicate him in contempt does not meet due process requirements, primarily because it doesn't tell him when he violated the order. The court's order was an ongoing order. It was one meant to be in place until such time as the court had adjudicated title to the funds. And contempt cases are sui juris. They're akin to criminal cases, and the courts look to criminal proceedings to determine what should be required or is required with regard to pleadings, rights, etc., in contempt cases. And I would submit to the court Benson v. State at 79 Southwest 2nd, 122, Court of Criminal Appeals, 1935 case, wherein Court of Criminal Appeals denied a writ of habeas corpus for a man who was sentenced to 15 years, and his indictment reflected that the offense of robbery occurred on or about the blank day of January 1934. No date indicated. Blank day of January 1934. And the Court of Criminal Appeals says, in that opinion, that the exact averment of the date of commission of the offense was immaterial, provided proof showed commission of the offense before indictment was returned and within the period of limitation. The court went on to say that the date itself is there for one reason and one reason only, and that's to assure the man that the charge is being brought before the indictment was returned and within the time limitations imposed for charging a person with that offense. The proof that the state can make can prove that the offense occurred on that date, before that date, or after that date, and therefore that date can be of no notice value to him in preparing a defense. And I submit to the court that is what the Court of Criminal Appeals says about indictments whereby a man was sentenced for 15 years. We should have no higher burden on a contempt situation in this case, particularly an ongoing contempt situation whereby the man had the funds in his control, custody, care, etc.
I have before me this brief that you filed in response. I find absolutely nothing in the show cause of this man being held in contempt in this matter. You file, you say, petitioner contends and requests the court declare some things, but I find nothing in this that ordered him to appear and show cause why he should be held in contempt. Do you have something else that you filed?
Are you looking at the original motion for contempt?
I have. This was filed apparently today.
And
I see nothing in this that shows that's an original motion for contempt.
No, Your Honor, I believe you have a brief. I filed a supplemental transcript today from the clerk of the trial court.
All right. It might well be in somewhere else.
Thank you.
Hear further argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, I'm William Bowers of Houston. I represent two of the claimants in the estate, Norman and John Kernahan. If I might briefly address the court with respect to some points that perhaps might be helpful. To begin with, the contention is not that this court should endorse a blanket enforcement of all oral orders. What we have before us is a relatively narrow and very specific oral instruction of the court. Specifically, and there is no evidence in the record to the contrary, there is an instruction of the probate court to bring certain funds back to Texas, not to spend them or do anything with them until you have an adjudication of who owns these funds. If you look at the court's docket notation, and if you look further at the pleading that was sworn to by Mr. Wilkins, there is no doubt under the record in this case that that order was in fact given and that Mr. Wilkins understood it. We have his own sworn statement to that effect in his pleading. Now, basically what he is charged with doing is disposing of these funds contrary to the court's specific instructions. This is not a lengthy or a complicated order that is difficult to understand or that is something that is capable of being misinterpreted. It was not misunderstood. It was not misinterpreted. Now, we realize that, of course, this is a quasi-criminal proceeding. If you look at the recent case out of the Fort Worth Court of Appeals where
contempt proceedings have been equated to a quasi-criminal proceeding, you have certain guidelines that the criminal law directs. But what we have here is a situation where, in this case, it is a question of was there fair notice of what he was required not to do. I think under the record in this case, that answer has got to be yes. If you will read the testimony in the record, look to the supplemental transcripts that sets out the text of the application to hold the relator in contempt, the show cause order, and you look at the evidence and the exhibits that were furnished when we got the supplemental transcript up here, and you see what the court had before it. You can see that in Judge Gregory's motion, rather his order of contempt and his punishment for it, that there is a basis, a factual basis in the record for these holdings. There was an order. There was a violation of that order, and that is amply supported by the evidence in the record before the probate court. Now, in this particular case, a big issue has been made about the fact that the order is oral. I think counsel's example of an order given upstairs in the courthouse, for example, don't speak to this juror. Don't discuss the testimony with someone else. And down in the coffee bar, the juror and a party have an extensive conversation. Obviously, that would be a contempt of the court. By analogy, when we look at this particular case, we have a situation where the court says, don't spend these funds until I find out who they belong to. The relator does that. Now, when you're talking about the recollection of the order, we direct the court's attention to the bank records that were introduced at the trial that shows when these funds were taken out and spent. This is much closer in time to the order. It is much closer in time to the filing of the sworn application for declaratory judgment. I don't think there's any doubt that Mr. Wilkins understood exactly and precisely what was said to him in that courtroom, and I don't think there's any doubt under this record that he deliberately disobeyed it. If you look...
The reason that we require our judgments to be in writing is because we don't get into these gray areas as to whether somebody did or did not have notice, whether the man was in the courtroom or not. I mean, when we start operating a punitive system, based upon oral orders that are enforced months, if we can enforce this one, well, we can enforce another one, and then another one, and then another one, and people would be going to jail by just what a judge remembers.
May it please the court, if I can respond to this. What we're saying is certainly if an attempt to enforce an order that is not reduced to a specific written memorandum is something that should be avoided in the normal case. It is only where you have something here, where you have a vital interest that is involved, a substantial amount of money, where you have a simple, direct, and easily understood order. This is not a case in which you are directed to go out and, say, seek the best money market rate that you can find for these funds over a given period of time. It is simply a direction, don't spend this money until we find out who it belongs to. In that very narrow area, not the broad spectrum of the many things that can come before the court, but in that very narrow area, that's what we're asking the court to enforce. That's what we think should be done, Your Honor. And you also have got a situation where we're dealing with a probate court that day in and day out has a large volume of property over which it has a responsibility, even more so than the normal district court or the courts of domestic relations. And in this particular case, under these particular very narrow circumstances, we think the order is and should be enforced. If I may add one other thing, the sequence of events that happened in this case is reflected by the court's docket, is that the order to show cause was issued. A hearing was held at which Mr. Wilkins and his counsel appeared. On their motion, a continuance was granted until the next week when the hearing was actually held, and with Mr. Wilkins before the court, and with having acknowledged having received a copy of the show cause order, he was required by the court to return the next week. The various witnesses were sworn, the various initial steps were done, so I don't think we have a problem with notice. I think the pleadings and everything in this case shows that Mr. Wilkins was given a fair notice and a fair shot at it. There is evidence in the record to support what Judge Gregory did. Unless he committed a fundamental error, a plain error in holding so under the evidence, I think his findings are entitled to the weight and respect of this court. I think, Your Honor, that this is one of those very narrow situations where this particular order should be enforced. Thank you.
Could you read this order for me? Judge Gregory,
the January 22nd order?
Right,
yes, Your Honor, I can. I have a copy of it here, if I may. The title is in the type portion is General Order of the Court, and it's in the estate of Franklin Carnahan, and it gives the estate number. It says 1-22-82, motion by Dennis Kelly to turn over.
This one starts off. The court takes judicial notice of something. That's
1-22-82.
Turn it to the top page. The order of January 20, 1984.
Court takes judicial notice of his record of hearing.
Recollection.
Yes, Your Honor. Of hearing 1-20-82.
Hearing of
1-22-82 and of subsequent. I cannot make that out, Your Honor. A subsequent conversation with counsel for F.D. Wilkins, finding that Floyd Dale Wilkins is in contempt of court, punishment set at 90 days jail, $500 fine, bond set at $5,000.
Thank you. I just couldn't read it. I'm sorry.
What that requires, in other words, the judge is taking judicial notice of something that happened 2 years ago, and upon the basis of that, is finding him in contempt. Here we've got an order that still is not reduced to writing, I suppose. What else did that order say that he may have violated?
Your Honor, I don't believe he's charged with violating anything.
I understand that, but tell me what else this order said that the judge had to rely upon his judicial notice of something that happened 2 years before.
Please,
you're representing this man. Tell us what else that order said that he might be guilty of. Or not guilty of.
The order, Your Honor, required the return of funds to the state of Texas.
Now that's here, that 12282 docket entry.
Yes, Your Honor.
Can you read that to us?
Yes, Your Honor. The docket sheet reflects the number of the cause, the estate of Franklin Carnahan. And it says, General Order of Court, 1-22-82, motion by Dennis Kelly to turn over assets, specifically $80,000 he claims was gift. Funds to be deposited in Texas and not to be spent, alienated, are bifurcated in any manner until title resolved, and it's signed Pat Gregory.
Does it say when they're to be?
It says until.
In Texas? Didn't it say when they're to be deposited in Texas, does it?
No, it did not, Your Honor.
Was this cash, $80,000 cash?
Yes, Your Honor, it was. It turned out that the funds which were actually deposited were $65,000. And the record reflects that that part of the order was complied with, that the funds were brought in within a week's time after this order was entered. They were deposited in the Texas Commerce Kingwood Bank and were kept there until the dates upon which the evidence showed that it was withdrawn. Your Honor, I'd like to make one final point. The contempt that we seek is to punish the spending of these funds prior to the adjudication of title. And it's on this very narrow, very easily understood portion of the order, very specific portion, that we're seeking the enforcement. That is the very narrow relief that we ask from Judge Gregory, and the enforcement of his order is what we ask from this court. We're not asking for a blanket endorsement of all oral orders. What we're asking for is the very narrow, very restricted holding that in this particular case there was a valid order not to spend the funds, that it was the funds were spent, that there is a record to support this, and that the Mr. Wilkins should be punished as the court has directed. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. In way of rebuttal, would first of all say that I don't believe that this court can distinguish this case from other cases with respect to constructive contempt for violation of an oral order.
Counselor, are you arguing that you could never be found guilty of contempt of an order before it's reduced in writing?
Your Honor, I'm arguing, yes, I am arguing that you cannot be held in constructive contempt. Now, direct contempt, yes, you could be held.
Well, a lot of cases say they are. Now, I think they've all been reduced to writing at the time of the hearing. And obviously, in most temporary injunction cases, the judge has the hearing, and he says, now, don't cut down that tree. And he turns to the other attorney and says, now, you draw up the order.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And you go out and cut down the tree, you're going to be in jail. And there's cases that hold that.
I understand that, Your Honor. And
I want to make clear, this order here has never been reduced to writing.
That is correct, even
but
to this day.
If they were to reduce this to writing and said that on such and such a day you were ordered to do this, you could be found in contempt, could you not?
Yes, Your Honor, I think you could. At the same time, with respect to this order, if it were reduced to writing and the entire motion and hearing that was held in this case, and if I could read for the court the show cause order that Mr. Wilkins received through his attorney, whether he was served with it or not, he certainly received it. And the show cause order ordered him to appear in Judge Gregory's court to show cause why he should not be adjudged by the court guilty of contempt for withdrawing and converting to his personal use the funds that were not to be spent until final disposition of this action under this court's order of January 22, 1982. The counsel in his argument seemed to say that we waived some type of a notice by appearing in court in response to that show cause order. And I think the record will reflect that prior to announcing ready to proceed in the motion to contempt, I made argument that the case be dismissed because the defendant had no notice of what he was charged with, how he was alleged to have violated the order, what the order was, and had no information with which to prepare a defense. And that motion and request was overruled by Judge Gregory, and then the case was heard. This man had no opportunity at any point to know what he was alleged to have done. They have argued quite extensively that the record reflects he spent the money. The record reflects only that a person from Texas Commerce Bank came into court and testified that Floyd Dale Wilkins, at some time in the last 2 years, had put $65,000 in a bank account. She didn't know where that money came from or what that money was, and that money had subsequently been drawn out of that account. There was no information from that person whether that was the money that was the subject of this lawsuit or anything else. We have not argued strongly that there is no evidence to support the finding of contempt because we feel very strongly that in this case, this oral order was not clear and specific, and further, that this defendant had no opportunity to prepare any type of a defense in this case. there's no question that this order should have been reduced to writing. It would have been and could have been done January 22nd, 1982, with a very minor bit of paperwork on the part of one of the attorneys. It wouldn't have taken any more than 5 minutes to reduce this order to writing. If Mr. Wilkins was present in court, he could have signed it at that time. And at this point, Mr. Wilkins would have some very serious problems if this order had been reduced. That's the extent of my argument. I appreciate it.
Thank you, counsel. The motion to file the supplemental transcript that was filed, I think the motion was filed this morning with several documents. That will be granted. Are those documents here?
Yes, Your Honor, they accompanied the motion that I filed with the clerk this morning.
Okay, that will be granted. The petition will be submitted to the court. That concludes the business of the court.
Your Honor, please rise. Oh, yes, oh, yes, oh, yes. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas.